Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Now, we have a very special guest for you now to guide us through the Christmas cooking and entertaining. He's one of my food heroes, but crucially, he's also a man who knows a thing or two about how to enjoy life. Rick Stein, you're very welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Brendan.
And Rick, you've taken us all over the world with your TV shows down the year, but you're home in Cornwall for your latest book. It's Rick Stein's Christmas, and it's a cookbook, but it's also full of stories and memories and musings on Christmas as well. You paint a beautiful picture at the start of the book about your Christmases as a child in the Cotswolds growing up. Tell us a bit about what they were like.
Well, I was just very lucky enough to have had a really idyllic childhood, really, Brendan. And the Cotswolds in those days was pretty special. I mean, it still is. It's now rather posh, but in my day it was a bit remote and very cold. I'm talking in the sort of 1950s, so we had no central heating, I recall, in the house. It was a farmhouse. But it was, my mother was a very good cook. My parents really loved Christmas. I mean, my dad was of German origin, although he was born in Britain. But there were sort of elements, I think, of our Christmas which hark back to Germany. I don't know whether other people at that time had real candles on the Christmas tree, because I don't recall whether there were electric candles in those days, but certainly we did. And my abiding memory of being a little child was the fact that because we had candles, real candles, you couldn't burn them for very long, otherwise you'd burn the house down. And me and my younger sister, Henrietta, were not allowed to see the Christmas tree on Christmas morning until the whole tree had been decorated and the candles lit. So coming into the big room in the farmhouse with all the candles lit and the smell of candles and Christmas tree was something that I'm sure that myself and my sister will never forget.
Yeah, that sounds magic. Yeah. And then in the blink of an eye, you're where you are now, and you're having your own Christmases, and you're the granddaddy now in a way. But will we work through the day a bit? So yeah. We start off, nibbles are vital, you say. I suppose they take the edge off at that point of the day, but they can be simple.
Yeah, well, it's just really that I've always taken a view, because we tend to open the presents sort of in the morning and have a glass or two of champagne. So you probably need something to sort of back up that sort of early, not sort of mid-morning hit of alcohol, yes, to be honest.
So you would say, though, it could be as simple as some good olives. You have a cheese straws recipe in the book as well, which is nice and simple.
The thing about what I was saying in the book about nibbles is they need to be pretty vigorous, because quite often when you have something, just a single bite, things, they're a bit sort of dull. So my cheese straws have got lots of cheese in it, lots of Parmesan in it, but also a fair amount of cayenne pepper as well.
So a bit of a flavour bomb. Tell me about Oysters, yeah, Kilpatrick, which I had not heard of. And obviously they'd be... Oysters Kilpatrick would be an even nicer dish in Ireland, because I'm sure you'd agree that the oysters we get here would be much better than anything you'd get.
Well, that's open to dispute, but I must say that we often feature the oysters from Strangford Lock, which are really superb. Well, Kilpatrick is actually, it sounds very Irish, but I've sort of looked at the origins of it, and I think it might actually be Australian, because that's where I got it from. But I mean, it's basically, if people don't like oysters, I'm sure they would like oysters that are actually grilled. In this case, they're grilled with bacon.
Yeah, and look, bacon never made anything worse, did it? It always improves everything. And listen, so you're having a few glasses of champagne at that point. You like a Negroni as well, I know, and I like a Negroni myself. What's your trick to perfect Negroni? I love a Negroni.
Well, I just get really irritated with all these sort of variations on Negroni, because you know, Negroni is just gin and vermouth, and that's the way it should be, really. But I don't, I sort of, people put sort of smoke things in it and other bits and bobs. One of my friends said about Negroni, the great thing about Negroni is it's a cocktail which uses gin as its mix. I think that sort of puts it in perspective. And also, there's a big argument about whether, obviously you have to have, well, you have to have orange peel in there, essential, goes with the Campari particularly well. But the other thing is some people say it should be one block of ice and others say it should be ice cubes. The block of ice people say, well, it looks much better. The ice cube people say, well, it gets colder quicker. So I just love it. It's a bit when they, like when you're talking about martinis, you know, how exactly is a perfect martini made? And I guess any drink like that, that has so much affection will also cause a lot of people to say, no, this is not the right way to do it.
Yeah, it's kind of like the oysters argument. We all think ours is the best. I do think what you say on gin being the mixer in there, I do think on Christmas Day, one Negroni is probably plenty for everyone early in the day, isn't it? What's a bull shot then?
Well, I only came across this quite recently. Actually, I was on a shoot with a load of chums from Ireland in Cornwall, right? And at about 11 o'clock, they produced this hot sort of toddy. This is 11 in the morning, which was actually beef stock, beef consomme and vodka. They offered me the choice of either vodka or sherry, so I went for the vodka. But it's a sort of like, It apparently, because I don't do a lot of shooting, but it's a sort of staple when you're out there and it's a cold day, you have a bull shot. So okay. I had to put it in the book.
Yeah, clears the pipes, I'd say, yeah. Now, on Christmas Day, do you also, we don't really have this option in Ireland, although there are various kind of vague situations in places like GAA clubs and stuff sometimes. Do you abandon ship right before the Christmas dinner to go to the pub for an hour?
Well, it's a recent habit, I must say, Brendan, but it's one that I really, really enjoy. It's just that for that 1 hour, and it's only an hour because it's not a session in the pub, it's just to meet people. That everybody in the village, this is St. Mirren, which is just outside Padstow, everybody turns out to the pub. And it's a chance to sort of see people you might not have seen all year. And there's just this sort of really special atmosphere because everybody's there and everybody knows you've only got an hour because you've got to get back and finish preparing the Christmas lunch. And it is a bit disruptive, I have to say, because if you take an hour out of your day at Christmas, you really got to be organised to make sure you get Christmas lunch or dinner. Or in our case, with the hour taken out, we don't start Christmas lunch till about 3:30. But there are certain times in the year that are particularly special, and for me that is special, really.
Starter I did like in the book, and I think you're saying, look, you don't necessarily need a starter, but if you do, keep it simple. Tell me about your prawn cocktail, which involves ketchup and whiskey.
Well, the thing is, I love my own cocktail sauce, which is basically Mary Rose sauce, which is ketchup and mayonnaise. But I found some years ago, I'm particularly fond of the malt whiskey from Isla, because it's got this sort of really peaty flavour, which makes it, in a prawn cocktail, just that little smoky back taste is something really quite special. I mean, I actually love Isla malt, but other people think it tastes a bit like sort of medicine, you know? I don't know. A bit overpowering, but each to his own, I say.
Yeah. I'm interested that you say you're veering towards cooking a goose. Now, I'm not a fan of turkey, so you're getting less rigid about having to have turkey, are you?
Well, I am, really, because I just think goose is sort of a much better flavour. And also, I love goose fat. I love making my roast potatoes with goose fat. I love the skin on the goose. I just think it's a far more interesting meat, really. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm actually having Christmas in Sydney. I'm leaving tomorrow this time, and the family in Sydney all always have a roast turkey. So, you know, it's fine.
Look, you and me are being polite about turkey, but we're both in agreement here that it's not the best. Let's face it, it can be a bit dry, it can be a bit tasteless. I ask this to every chef I ever have on around this time of the year. Have you any trick to make turkey more exciting than it is, or is it just what it is?
Well, of course I have. But, I mean, it's very simple, really. Don't overcook it. Get yourself a probe, like a thermometer, like a temperature probe, because really you shouldn't cook and turkey any more than about 70 degrees. That's safe cooking. And don't let it cook any more, because I think sometimes when you hear how long people cook their turkey for, it's like
yes.
hours, you know?
Yes.
And then they say it's a very dry meat. Well, of course
it
is.
Yeah, yeah. The Christmas traditional drying out of the turkey over 10 hours, yeah. I do think ham is central, though. Any tips on the ham or tell us about your glaze, maybe?
Well, I mean, I think it's worth spending a bit of money in getting ham from, I mean, we got a local butcher here in Cornwall, which I swear by. So that's the first thing. Obviously, you've got to make a decision whether you have smoked or green gammon. I prefer at Christmas, I prefer just non-smoked. And again, you don't need to cook it too much, really. I think that's the other thing. What you do is, of course, you boil it or simmer it. And I actually simmer it with a tiny bit of chili in it, some peppercorns, a few cloves and bay leaves and cider. I really like ham cooked in cider. And then the glaze, you cook it and then you take the skin off and then you stud it with cloves. And the glaze I use is always mustard and brown sugar. And you just put it back in the oven. Really, it's not really roast. You just put it back in the oven long enough to make the glaze all melting and shining. And the flavour of the cloves and the brown sugar and the mustard is quite special to me. And then, of course, I've got to have braised red cabbage with it.
Yeah, you make it all sound so simple, but I suspect somehow yours is better than mine. Now, you make the gravy on Christmas Eve. How is that even possible?
Well, I mean, I just think it's probably good to get ahead, just simply because making gravy, if you've got a number of people sitting down to lunch, making gravy at the last minute when everybody's trying to talk to you about everything is quite tricky. So I'm sort of suggesting making it the day before. And I always go for a free-range turkey or goose. So you get the giblets, right?
Right.
And I make a gravy by making a stock with the giblet. Then I add chicken stock. I've got a deep freeze full of chicken stock because I just love making stock. And I just make the basic gravy, and I thicken it a little bit, not too much. And I just get the right colour in the gravy. Then all I do when I'm serving the lunch, just before it, I take the turkey out of the roasting tray and just deglaze the bottom of the tray with some of the gravy and then put it back, strain it back into the gravy.
Okay, so you do get some of your pan residue into the gravy on the day. Okay, yeah.
No, yeah. Can't afford to lose that, no.
Okay, what about the perfect roast potato, Rick?
Well, again, I think I did an experiment this last Christmas. It's perfectly okay to parboil the potatoes the day before Christmas, on Christmas Eve, and just leave them out, but you don't put them in the fridge because it does change the taste then.
Okay.
So if you've got them all parboiled and ready to go. And the other thing I've realised, and I've done this forever, I roast in duck fat or goose fat. You don't need to put the potatoes into hot fat. You just put everything in together and then put a bit in the hot oven. You still get the same result.
Really?
And I always use... Yes, yes. And I always use Maris Piper or King Edward's potatoes, and I just parboil them till the edges are sort of fluffy, but then I add something like semolina or polenta just to increase the fluffiness. Because what I really like is a roast potato with a sort of crisp but sandy texture. That's what I particularly like.
So I'll give you something that I learned, I think, from my mother as a kid. If you parboil the potatoes on the day, what you can do is bring them out into the cold for a minute while they're hot and just give them a very gentle shake outside.
Perfect.
And it'll give you that rougher edges on it too.
Yeah, I love that element of outside, you know.
Yeah. Listen, you're taking the carving of the meat off stage, are you?
Well, really, because I mean, I just remember my dad carving it at the table. It just took forever. And of course, we've always had like 10 plus 12 people for even when I was a child. So it takes quite a while to carve the turkey for all those people. And if you're the sort of people that don't like starting to eat before everybody's served, well, you're going to have cold food, aren't you? I'm always saying to my guests or my family, do start. But and one of the things I used to say was the past queen always used to tell everybody to start, because in one of her sort of country houses or palaces, the kitchen was miles away, so you had no chance of having hot food. But I just think it's much easier, actually, to carve it off scene.
Yeah.
Because then you can really get down to it. And in fact, my son Jack does all the carving, which is very handy.
Yeah, you see, the other thing is you're carving away with 12 people watching as well. When you think about it, it's ridiculous. You're there sweating away over it. Some of them have got their meat. They're waiting. So just get it carved and bring it out carved. I like it. Okay, so we're into desserts now. You had a lovely little story in the book about last Christmas. You found these Christmas puddings of unknown origin in the garage.
In the garage. I'm as a child, I hated Christmas pudding because it was far too rich. It was sort of overpowering. These days, I'm still not a massive fan. And the recipe I've got there has actually got a lot more nuts in it. It isn't quite as sort of rich as some. But the reason, actually, this time I'm going to Sydney for Christmas and I've got a couple of Christmas puddings in luggage, you know, because they do keep. That's what a great thing when you think about the amount of sugar and fat and alcohol that's in a Christmas pudding. Of course it's going to keep.
But the ones you found in the garage, they were potentially a year or more old. Are they indestructible, basically, yeah?
Well, I don't know.
But you're still here to tell the tale.
I'm still here. Yeah. But there's almost nothing. There's nothing to spoil in them, really. You know.
Yeah. Any still other good, forever, good, easy desserts ideas for people?
Well, I mean, I've got a couple of ice creams in there, and actually a nice trifle. It's a Black Forest trifle, which is sort of a as they say these days, a riff on the Black Forest gâteau. So it's got the sort of black cherries and chocolate in it. And I just think if you don't like Christmas pudding, it'd be a really good alternative, I think.
Yeah,
well, it's very nice. I would say that, though, wouldn't I?
Yeah. But look, let's face it, a lot of people don't like Christmas pudding. I think if we're going to be honest about the turkey, let's be honest about the pudding. So will there be a big gang of you in Sydney?
Yeah, it's 12. And it'll be sort of very similar to Christmas over here in the fact that the family, as I said, like a roast and all the veg. But it'll start off with a swim in the summer at Balmoral Beach. And then we have breakfast on the beach at the swimming club, which is a bit different. And around the beach, there'll be loads of people with rugs on the grass getting ready for an outdoor Christmas. But ours, there's 12 of us. But the thing there is that there's not just one person that cooks everything, which these days is me. It used to be my mum, of course.
Yeah.
Everybody contributes. So I'm just doing the veg and the turkey. Then others are bringing the beef, the ham, the Christmas pudding. And always what we have to start with is oysters and prawns.
Okay, that sounds divine. Listen, you have a little section in the book about Christmas number ones and the type of music you like to listen to at Christmas. You veer more towards the melancholy kind of Christmas music than the jolly stuff, do you?
I do, Brendan, because I think it's funny because I think my favourite Christmas number one is A Fairy Tale of New York. It's a bit sort of melancholy, but there's some... I think the thing about Christmas is it lifts you up, and it's quite nice to start with a Christmas song that sounds a bit melancholy, but behind it there's always a sense of redemption, really, I think. And interestingly, about Fairy Tale of New York, I just went on the internet and just were looking to see what Americans thought of the fairy tale of New York, and they don't know it, or they don't like it. And the reason they don't like it is they don't like that sort of melancholic element in their Christmas songs. It's all about sort of jollity and sleigh bells and, you know.
Yeah, forced jollity, as you might call it. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Rick, one thing about that nice melancholy at Christmas, that, as you say, there's normally then a redemption or a move to the more seasonal mood. I feel the dead are often more with us at Christmas as well. Do you think about your dad at Christmas?
Well, I do, because, I mean, it was just, you know, going to church on Christmas Day with my dad all dressed up, you know, as was appropriate in those days, and how really special that was. And again, the sense of belonging and the sense of occasion there, I think.
Yeah, but presumably all the more precious because of your dad died tragically, as we say, then when you were just 18.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I suppose that's also why my childhood was so sort of special to me, because what happened after that was not, you know. So it's sort of like the blue remembered hills, really. It's sort of, it means a lot to me because of what happened later.
Yeah, yeah. So look, all human life in there, and life in all its rich pageant. Rick Stein, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Brendan.
Yeah,
thank
the book you. The book is called Rick Stein's Christmas. Have a great Christmas in Australia, Rick. And this is for you now to finish up the show, your all-time favourite Christmas song. This is Fairy Tale of New York. Rick Stein, happy Christmas.
Oh, brilliant, Brendan. Thank you very much.
When you first took my hand on a cold Christmas Eve, you promised me Broadway was waiting for me. You were handsome.
You were pretty queen of New York City.
When the band finished playing, they held on for more. Sinatra was swinging, all the drums they were singing. We kissed on the corner, then danced through the night. The boys of the NYPD choir were singing Galway Bay. And the bells were ringing out for Christmas Day.
RTE.ie.